Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's not exactly free money, but the Federal Reserve's interest rates are pretty low, you know. So is that good news or is it bad news? Discuss amongst yourselves. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for the 26th of January. Glad you could be with us. And on the theory that there's nothing like a little monetary policy to whet your appetite for the news of the day, we're going to start this Thursday by quoting the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States. They wrapped up a two-day meeting on interest rates yesterday by saying this. There will be, quote, exceptionally low levels for the federal funds rate at least through late 2014. That means the Fed's main interest rate is going to stay near zero for almost another 2 years. Ben Bernanke and his colleagues are trying to goose the economy by making it cheaper to borrow for a house or a car, or if you own a business, to buy computers or fancy new robots to make your company more efficient and profitable. But Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains low interest rates do have a couple of downsides, too.
For Jim Peterba, worry about low, low interest rates hits pretty close to home.
My dad, who's living on income from CDs, for those who are depending on relatively safe interest income, this is a message that it's going to be a continued period of difficulty generating that income.
Peterba teaches at MIT and heads up the National Bureau of Economic Research, so you might spare some worry for the retirees in your life, too. Interest rates average just over 0.5% now on savings accounts and CDs. In fact, some economists worry that the Fed's policies will lead retirees to shift their nest eggs into riskier investments to get a higher return. But for businesses, low interest rates are an unmitigated good. They can borrow cheaply for buildings or new machinery and the software to run it. Brookings economist Gary Burtless says in some cases this may actually keep companies from hiring more people in the long run.
The theory is these investments have made businesses so much more efficient that they do not add as much to their payrolls as they otherwise would.
But Burtless says this process generates jobs, too. Jim Peterba agrees.
There's also someone who's producing that machine, right? Someone's assembling the robot. Somebody's writing the software code. And those are the folks who are getting the jobs that are immediately stimulated by the investment.
Peterba says we just have to hope some of these high-paid engineering and technology jobs making all the fancy new equipment stay in the United States. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Today, Defense Secretary Leon Panetta explained exactly how he's going to cut $500 billion out of the Pentagon's budget over the next 10 years. Fewer soldiers, fewer big weapons systems, and more technology, robots and drones and cyber defense. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale explains that means the defense industry is going to have to change as well.
Secretary Panetta said the mandate to cut more than 8% from the budget required difficult choices.
The military will be smaller and leaner, but it will be agile, flexible, rapidly deployable, and technologically advanced.
The Army and Marines will lose 90,000 troops over the next 5 years, but still be larger than they were before 9/11. The Navy and Air Force will gain significant new investments in technologies. Sophisticated surveillance and attack drones will make up more of the military arsenal, and that's a big change for makers of traditional military aircraft.
In an ideal world, a company would want to be in both lines of work.
William Hartung with the Center for International Policy says big contractors like Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman already make both, but drones cost one-fifth or less than fighter planes.
If you're going to have significant slashes in a fighter plane program, you're probably going to lose more contracting money than you're going to gain, in the short term at least, by building drones.
Plus, there's more competition in the drone building business. A small California firm called AeroVironment is making a bird-sized drone that can be carried in a backpack, allowing soldiers to look over the next hill or building. Each cost about $120,000, not the kind of multi-billion-dollar scale most big defense contractors are used to.
It's a serious adjustment because the companies really thought that the budgets were going to go up and up indefinitely, and now they've had sort of a rude awakening.
In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
A moment now to observe a rare corporate resuscitation from the brink of what looked to be a looming disaster. Remember last year when Netflix jacked up its prices, split its DVD-by-mail service off from its streaming one, and promptly lost 800,000 subscribers and watched its stock get hammered? Fast forward to today, Netflix shares up 22% on a stellar earnings report. All those angry subscribers? Not so angry now, I guess. The company says it's signed up more than 500,000 new ones. But what exactly does new subscriber mean? Anyway, it's not so simple a question, turns out, as Gregory Warner explains.
Let me start with a non-Netflix story. When Alicia Weeks moved to Seattle, she noticed lots of yoga studios offering the same introductory deal. 10 days of unlimited yoga for $10.
I'm just hopping from studio to studio, trying to give them minimal information to get back in touch with me and you know, kind of get as much yoga as I can for $10 for 10 days.
Can any of those studios count Alicia Weeks as a member? Well, not yet. Now look at Netflix. Of the 600,000 new subscribers it says it added by the end of December, 97% of them were still on a free trial. Tony Weibel looks at tech stocks for Janney Capital Markets. He explains that Netflix was still losing customers in October and November because of that price hike. And then came Christmas, with all those gifts of iPads and Kindles and Nooks.
A lot of devices were sold with free Netflix trials embedded within them.
All you had to do was click the Netflix app and sign up. And hundreds of thousands of people did.
You know, a lot of people have become pretty expert at signing up for free offers. And so I think one of the risks for Netflix is that people start to game the system.
Barton Crockett follows media stocks at Lazard Capital Markets. He says Netflix has a strong retention rate. 9 out of 10 free subscribers become paying customers, at least for a little while, either because they like the movies or they forget to cancel. Which reminds me, you Christmas newbies, your free trial expired yesterday. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Yesterday, oh snap. You remember how Mitchell Hartman was telling us there are downsides to low interest rates? Wall Street came to the same conclusion today. We'll have the sad music when we do the numbers. If you were asked to pick the iconic American company right now, right at the top of most lists would be Apple. Once a fringe, cultish computer company, now maker of things that everybody wants. It got that way with great design, an eye for perfection, and a whole lot of Chinese factory workers. Charles Duhigg has been writing about the economics of Apple's supply chain in the New York Times this week, and in a story that went up online yesterday, he told us the story of a 22-year-old Chinese man named Lai Xiaodong and the job that Mr. Lai got at Foxconn, one of Apple's biggest suppliers.
He was assigned to a room where they were sanding, polishing the iPad cases. As aluminum dust built up in the air from the polishing, it eventually got to a critical point where it exploded. Mr. Lai was killed along with three others and dozens injured.
And the official response from Apple and from Foxconn on this was what?
Both of them said that they opened up investigations, although neither company has revealed any of the documents or any of the findings from when they sent folks in. Conditions in Chinese factories are harsh. They're much harsher than they are in, for instance, the United States or any other Western nation. And when I talk to former Apple employees, what they say is that if Apple and Amazon and Dell and Hewlett-Packard, if they all came in and they insisted that conditions be improved to a situation where there are no safety hazards, Chinese manufacturers would have to comply. But the problem is that right now, there's not a lot of reward for doing so, particularly when insisting upon changes would probably slow down the pace of innovation significantly and would very likely raise costs for a number of those companies.
Let me explore that pace of innovation point, because that is at the core of the article that came out yesterday and the one that came out over the weekend as well. And that is how quickly companies expect manufacturers to be able to turn to get what consumers want. And you tell a great story about the glass in the iPhones. And when Steve Jobs said, I want a glass screen, make it happen.
Absolutely. And they were able to turn that around, overhaul their manufacturing process, and within 48 hours, get these glass screens into workers' hands and start producing finished iPhones because there's this enormous flexibility. These factories can hire 3,000 people overnight. It's an amazing scale.
Well, here comes the look in the mirror question, right? Because there is a demand issue here that's helping drive this whole thing.
Oh, there's huge demand, right? You know, we did a national poll as part of this story, and we asked people, first of all, where do you think that Apple's products are made? Most people who responded didn't know that they were made overseas primarily, or how much of them was made overseas. And then we asked, what's the worst thing that you know about Apple? 57% of people couldn't think of anything negative about the company.
Wow.
The number one response at 14% was that their products are too expensive. 2% of respondents mentioned overseas labor conditions.
Play this out for me then. Where does, if change is going to come, where's change going to come from?
Where the change has to come from is it has to come from consumers starting to say, listen, I really care about where my product comes from. I'm willing to pay more for it if it's built in a factory I can feel good about. And more importantly, I'm willing to wait longer for a new version. We live in a time when there's a brand new device, it seems like, every couple of months. And they're amazing and wonderful. But there's a price to that.
Charles Duhigg, writing in the New York Times with David Barboza about Apple and the iEconomy. Charles, thanks a lot.
Kai, thanks so much for having me.
You have to pair the economics of Apple and the iEconomy and the regular economy, too, with the politics of the moment in this country. Apple co-founder Steve Jobs, just as one example, was mentioned in both President Obama's State of the Union Tuesday night and the Republican response. Commentator Robert Reich says there has to be government help for the American economy because the private sector has focused its efforts elsewhere.
A defining issue in the 2012 campaign will be the relative roles of business and government in making Americans globally competitive. But American business can't lead the way because it's increasingly global, with less and less stake in America. And its goal is profits, not better jobs. According to the Commerce Department, U.S.-based global corporations added almost 2.5 million workers abroad over the past decade, but they cut their U.S. workforce by about 3 million. Apple employs 8 times as many workers overseas as it does in the United States. An Apple executive recently told the New York Times, "We don't have an obligation to solve America's problems." At the same time, the National Science Foundation warns that Asia's share of global R&D spending now exceeds America's. One big reason? Over the last decade, American firms nearly doubled their R&D investment in China. No wonder the President's Council on Jobs and Competitiveness, dominated by corporate CEOs, is calling for lower tax rates and less regulation. These CEOs are beholden to their shareholders, not to American workers. And these proposals mean higher earnings per share, but they won't create better jobs. Americans will get good jobs in the global economy only if they're productive enough to attract them. But a large and growing portion of our workforce isn't equipped to be productive. We're hobbled by deteriorating schools, unaffordable college tuitions, decaying infrastructure, and declining investment in basic R&D. All of this is putting us on a downward slope toward even lousier jobs and lower wages in the future. Big American corporations aren't clamoring for better education and infrastructure. They want lower taxes and fewer regulations. And they have huge clout in Washington, with legions of lobbyists and boatloads of money for political campaigns. That's the problem in a nutshell. When it comes to making Americans globally competitive, almost no one with any clout in Washington is representing Americans.
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. His most recent book is called Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. Tell us what you think. Go to marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. The old phrase, freedom doesn't come free, has been playing out in Egypt pretty clearly over the past year. Since Hosni Mubarak was deposed, there have been parliamentary elections, but the Egyptian economy seems to be stuck. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is in Cairo for our series One Year On. It's about Egypt's post-revolutionary economy and how people are faring in it. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
So let's test the premise here. 1 year on, are Egyptians better off economically?
Many are not better off because of the continuing unrest and uncertainty. Tourism and foreign investment here have fallen off a cliff. 20% of the people depend on the tourist trade, so many are suffering. Many of the cab drivers I've spoken to in this city say their earnings are down by a half. But there is one small group of wily entrepreneurs that have been doing very nicely out of the crisis.
Fresca, Camila, Camila, fresca!
Yes, the street vendors of Tahrir Square. That guy was selling a small sweet called Fresca, but they sell everything the protesters might need, including, during the recent unrest, cheap Chinese gas masks to protect against tear gas.
Wow. Now, is that Tahrir Square I hear behind you there, Stephen?
It is indeed.
Wow. What about, you know, mini vendors aside, what about the rest of the economy, the bigger picture?
Things are bad. Things are worse than under Mubarak. I mean, growth has slowed to only about 1% compared with around 5% under the last year of the Mubarak regime. He was achieving sort of 6 or 7% annual growth rates. But Ahmed Galel of the Economics Research Forum says those growth rates are misleading.
The Egyptian economy was being sold to a lot of people as a tiger on the Nile, because economic growth was relatively high, but the trouble was most of the benefits were going to a few.
That, of course, was one of the reasons for the revolution. Poverty, 40% of the people in this country live on around $2 a day.
So a year on, though, Stephen, a year after this revolution, what are the prospects? I mean, what could go right and what could go wrong?
Well, the biggest threat is probably the Islamists. They won 70% of the parliamentary seats in the recent election, and that has raised, at least for some people, the spectre of a country sort of lurching back into some sort of fundamentalist backwater with a government hostile to business. But a leading Egyptian businessman, Tarek Torfik, says he doesn't believe it. He doesn't think that Egypt will turn into another Iran.
Iran has an oil pump. The regime can finance his way or buy his way out. All the resources of Egypt are integrated in the global economy. Egypt cannot afford to go at odds with the world.
He says the country can't isolate itself. It cannot, for example, ban alcohol or ban bikinis on the beach because it depends so heavily on tourism.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in Cairo in Tahrir Square, just overlooking it in his hotel room, as you can hear. Stephen, thanks a lot.
Okay, Kai.
Coming up,
Sundance is the coolest brand in the culture of the moment.
And it's not all about the movies, by the by. But first, let's do the numbers. Some discouraging housing data hung over the stock market today. The Dow Industrials lost 22 points, about a 10%, finished at 12,734. The Nasdaq sagged 13 points, 0.4%, closed at 2805. The S&P 500 gave back 7 points, a 0.5%, settled at 1318. Home building companies got hammered today, blame the news that new home sales tumbled in December and hit a record low last year. Toll Brothers slumped 5%, Lennar sank 3%, but businesses are buying more equipment, and that gave a boost to several U.S. manufacturers. The world's biggest equipment maker, Caterpillar, drove up 2%, 3M posted a gain of 1.25% today. Yesterday, we told you about JCPenney's new pricing strategy. Today, JCPenney shares rallied 19% on the shiny profit projections for 2012. Bond prices rose on this Thursday. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 1.94%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The United Nations observes the International Day of Commemoration in memory of the victims of the Holocaust. The Commerce Department releases its advance estimate gross domestic product report for the fourth quarter of 2011. And dancer and actor Mikhail Baryshnikov turned 64. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There's news today for all you backyard gardeners out there. The shrub in the backyard that died this past spring? The tomato plants that went nowhere last summer? Maybe it wasn't you after all. The Department of Agriculture has a new map out today showing recommended seasonal planting times. They've changed because average winter temperatures have risen in a lot of places, and that could change what gardeners grow and what nurseries sell. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Tro reports.
What do gardeners do in winter when the ground is frozen? They lust after new plants to grow in the spring. Catherine Watecki at the Department of Agriculture says the new map will let them plan better than ever. Online, you can drill down to the microclimates.
Where you can see either heat islands or cool islands, slope of land, elevation, and nearness to bodies of water.
In North Carolina, Blair Durant just mailed the 2012 catalogs for the company Niche Gardens. He says northern customers may be tempted by new options.
It's just warm enough so that there are a few tropical plants that you could grow that you couldn't grow 10 years ago. You know, grow bananas in Ohio now if they want.
But the new map is no guarantee. One hard winter will wipe them out. And warmer temperatures bring unwelcome guests.
Bugs that used to live only in the south are now moving up north. And that's sort of a big deal.
You may be able to grow a new tender rose, but you could also battle new mites that attack it. George Ball at the Burpee Gardening Company says warmer winters mean worse results for some plants.
Apples need a colder winter. For an apple to really crisp up well, it wants that winter for which it is adapted.
He says the new maps mostly affect so-called hardy plants that grow through the winter, like fruit trees or the trees and shrubs in your local park. The tomatoes or petunias you plant every spring, they'll mostly stay the same. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Fifteen of 16 ski lifts are open in Park City, Utah today. Packed powder is the surface, 41 degrees up on the mountain, which is great, but not really what I want to talk about. The Sundance Film Festival is on this week. Independent filmmakers gathering to show off their movies. Studios, everybody hopes, buying the rights to them. Tom Bernard is the co-president of Sony Pictures Classics. He's in Park City. Tom, thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
How long have you been coming to Sundance?
I've been coming to Sundance since 1983.
All right, so here's why I ask. It used to be that the buzz coming out of Sundance was that's the place indie filmmakers go. They make a deal and the studios come in and buy the pictures. And it seems to me we haven't been hearing that buzz lately.
Well, you know, that's sort of a myth. There was always the one big movie that got bought from a company that wanted to get on the map. You go back to movies like Spitfire Grill and Happy Texas. And big money was paid and headlines were made and the movies were never heard from again. But, you know, Sundance is a place where business is done, but it's not big business. It's not the thing every filmmaker dreams. He's going to have a screening. 1,000 people are going to be in the theater, and when it's over, people are going to take tickets to get in line to pay them more money than the next guy. And it never has and doesn't work that way.
You've got a couple of movies up there. Spike Lee's up there, I understand, with his new film. I mean, there's still people who go to Sundance trying to drum up business, right?
Well, you know, it's much more than that. Sundance is the coolest brand in the culture of the moment. And the people that come here, you're not just filmmakers. You've got musicians. You've got athletes. You've got anyone who wants to rub off on the coolness of the Sundance brand. I just walked up the street to do this interview, and there's a girl who has a little hummus lunch kit that she wanted me to have. And she had three people with hummus shirts walking down the street handing it out.
So, I mean, does that kind of bum you out, though, that it's not the place where indie filmmakers go anymore to really sort of, you know, preach their craft?
Well, you know, it's always been that, you know, but it's gotten to the point where the films are now bigger than the brands.
Yeah.
The fact is there are more places now for your movie to be seen, which is the goal of, I think, most filmmakers when they come here. Companies like myself, Sony Pictures Classics, and we've bought two movies here, Celeste and Jesse Forever, and a documentary called Looking for Sugar Man, and they are going to go the traditional theatrical route. There's other movies, I think, that are just going to go straight to cable. So it's a really vibrant marketplace. It's just not big dollars being thrown around.
What do you look for when you're going to buy an independent film? I mean, what was it about Celeste and Jesse Forever that made you say, you know what, I'm going to buy that. I want that.
I'll tell you. Celeste and Jesse Forever is one of the first movies, I think, that's made about sort of the 20-something generation. It's a relationship movie about a couple going through a divorce. And what I saw when I was in the screening and sort of deduced by just figuring out what we can do with the picture is this movie is going to connect to a generation that really hasn't had a movie made for them.
Let me ask you very quickly about that generation, the 20-somethings who are out there now trying to find jobs straight out of college or you know, looking for a job after they've been laid off. Is there any disconnect between what's going on in Hollywood and Park City this week and what's going on out in the actual economy?
No, I don't think so, because I think Park City is full of those people here looking for jobs and looking to figure out somehow how to connect to the movie industry. Business happens here. It's a mixing pot for business. And it's a mixing spot for especially the 20-something.
Tom Bernard, co-president of Sony Pictures Classics, up in Sundance in Park City, Utah. Tom, thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke, you may or may not know, used to be a tenured member of the economics faculty at Princeton University. Well, it seems he misses the classroom a bit. This morning, the Fed announced Mr. Bernanke will be teaching a couple of undergrad classes at George Washington University this spring. The Federal Reserve and its role in today's economy is the class title. So we went out to campus today to see what kind of crowd he might get.
I'm glad GW got him.
Looking forward to potentially getting a class with the chairman of the Fed.
Just anything he can teach us would be phenomenal.
Yeah, but I don't like economics.
Yeah, you know what? Me neither. All right, we got to go. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow lost 22 points, about a tenth of 1%. The NASDAQ sagged 13 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 gave back 7 points. That's about a half percent. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, Lisa Tucker, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can tune into the Marketplace Morning Report tomorrow for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time back here, you take the internet, add high unemployment and higher corporate profits, and stir.
10 years of economic and technological progress had produced some very feisty young people. Once they get angry, they become very efficient at organizing protests.
Why last year went the way it did. I'm Kai Rizdal. I do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, that's American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.